Hello and welcome to Ship for Speech, the podcast for professionals in public finance. This week's episode is all about the health sector, focusing on the rollout of the COVID-19 vaccination programme in the UK. First to give us a perspective from the sector is editor of Pulse magazine, Jamie Caffish.
So I'm here with Jamie Caffish, editor of Pulse magazine. Thank you very much for joining us today, Jamie.
Thank you for having me.
So for our listeners who might not know about Pulse, could you give us a bit of background on the kind of stories that you cover, the audience that you're serving, and a bit about your journalistic background?
Sure, of course. So we are the magazine for GPs. We're the biggest magazine for GPs in the country. That's pretty much our only audience. So obviously we've had quite a lot to write about over this last year or so. It's been probably the busiest time in my career anyway. And especially in the last couple of months, this vaccination programme has been a huge, huge issue. It's pretty much everything we're writing about, in fact. We celebrated our 60th birthday last year, and I keep telling everyone, I think we had our very biggest story, biggest ever exclusive last year as well, where we announced the start of the vaccination programme was going to be in December at a time when nobody had an idea about that. So we were able to break that news as well. Now, other than that, obviously, we do a fair amount of clinical stories, but I would say the majority of the stories are more about NHS, more about politics and more about the structure of the NHS and GP's payments. And we do often cover from a GP partner's point of view. So there is quite a bit of finance to that as well, as your readers will know. From my journalistic background, actually, I started my career in the UK, at least, at Public Finance, as sub-editor, actually. Moved over after a couple of years to Accountancy Age and now landed at Pulse. So obviously I've got no, as you can probably tell, I've got no medical or clinical experience in the past, but I've now been at Pulse for 7 years, rising up from senior reporter to news editor to deputy editor, and now for the last, well, almost 3 years I've been editor.
Amazing. So yeah, it doesn't surprise me in the slightest that you've had an incredibly busy year. So obviously you touched on the vaccine story there, which is what you kindly agreed to join us today to talk about. So based on the coverage you've been doing over the last year, what are your general reflections on the COVID vaccination rollout so far and on the government's vaccination plan that they published?
Yeah, I think I made myself quite unpopular with some parts of the readership anyway by actually giving lukewarm praise to the government on the vaccination programme. I actually think if we look at all the big programmes that they've done over this last year, the vaccination programme has been by far and away the most successful. You compare it to Test and Trace, for example, or the shielding, which obviously had quite a big impact on local councils as well. It's a million miles away. I actually think that they've done pretty well when it comes to vaccinations. Now, they sourced a number of vaccinations way beforehand. They put the money into the AstraZeneca vaccine as well. And they were the first ones to approve it. Now, whether this was a little bit of a alpha male, we're the first to do it, I don't know. But actually, you know, it's proved to be fairly successful. And actually, we are at a point now where we're doing a lot of vaccinations. Like I said, it's been fairly successful. Now, if you think about this vaccination programme, it is almost certainly the biggest public health programme that's ever been done in this country. It's been rolled out in a minuscule amount of time. If you think about how long it's taken to roll this out from when we first announced it, anyway, at the start of November, that the NHS was planning for this, you know, we're already on 400,000 vaccines a day. That's a pretty phenomenal effort. I can completely understand there's a bit of cynicism around because the government has failed on many of its large programs. But actually, in terms of vaccination, I would give it a pretty lukewarm praise. I'd give it a decent amount of praise so far, actually.
So you spoke there about the Test and Trace programmes, the relative levels of success, shall we say. What do you think has made this programme so much more successful than some of the other programmes surrounding COVID?
I think this is quite an easy answer, but the fact that NHS has been mainly involved in this, it's been done on a public sector level, it's been delivered by mainly GPs, but also trusts as well, and it's been organised by the NHS. So for all talk of the NHS, you know, it's pretty effective, really, when compared with, let's say, some of the companies that have been offering Test and Trace. It's as successful. We've got the infrastructure in place. There are vaccination programmes that are being run every year. The flu vaccination programme is being run every year. While that's not on the same scale as this programme, and certainly not the same speed, there is that infrastructure in place. And it has been left to the NHS. We haven't got private companies involved. The other thing is, this is our way out as well. So I think that has been an element as well. It's something that we knew from the start would be our way out. So I think to give government a bit of praise on this, you know, it's something that they were looking at from the very start of the pandemic and before lockdown to get this vaccination process. So there has been a bit of preparation, but again, the scale of this and in the speed it's been done has been really impressive. But I would say it's been delivered on a public sector level with infrastructure already in place.
You said there about the role of GPs and that they've mostly delivering the vaccination programme to date so far. So what have been kind of the main challenges from the GPs that you've been speaking to? What have they reflected on as the things that are going well and the things that the challenges they're having to overcome?
Without question, the main problem has been supplies. Either there's not enough or they have been haphazard. So we do hear plenty of GPs that have said that their vaccines, we don't know how many vaccines are coming on a particular day. It's been delayed or they've been getting it early and therefore they haven't got the appointments to give the vaccine to. So I think that to me has been the biggest challenge. Now, again, I'd like to temper that a little bit. Again, I want to make the point, this has been the biggest vaccination public health programme of all time. To get it delivered in this time, there will be mistakes made, but that has been a challenge. In terms of delivery in these hubs that they're doing it, so I'm not sure if your listeners will know, but the majority of the vaccines are being delivered by GP hubs, which primary care networks, which are normally made up of 3 or 4 practices, and they're the ones that are really delivering it. So it's not been done on a practice level. But there is another challenge in there as well. Having spoken about the infrastructure being already in place, the flu vaccination, for example, is done on a GP practice level. All GPs would be really in favour of this happening now. It could be done now. When it first started with the Pfizer vaccine, I don't know if that really was an option. It can't really be moved that easily, but the AstraZeneca one can be moved a lot more easily. So we have seen some PCN hubs delivering their Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine to their, you know, the smaller GP practice. It's not really happening enough. And I think what GPs would really like to see is for this to be done at a practice level, for a proper green light from NHS England saying this is how we want to be doing it from now on. It was something that I actually raised in a briefing with the Prime Minister, and obviously I didn't get any answer to that whatsoever. I answered a completely different question to the one I asked, but I think to me this is the biggest issue for GPs at the moment. It's the biggest challenge. Final thing I'd like to say, just on the finances, so they are being given a bit more money than the flu vaccine, and they are receiving money for each dose. So it's around £12.58 for per dose, and they get getting, obviously they've got to administer 2 doses. They're also getting a bit extra for delivering it to care home residents as well. Again, I think from what we have heard, this isn't a moneymaker for GPs. This is covering costs, but I think majority of GPs do feel that this is a duty of theirs, understandably, that they are part of this massive effort. So in terms of finances, there is a bit more money going into it. However, what we understand is that it's pretty much covering costs at the moment.
So one of the big issues around the vaccination programme, and it's the one that I keep seeing pop up in the press again and again, is around the decision to kind of space out doses. Do you have a personal view on the government's decision to space the doses out to 12 weeks? And what is the feeling from the GPs that you're speaking to?
So I think, this is obviously such a big issue at the moment. Now, my feeling on this is that this is an impossible decision to make. From what we hear from GPs, I think it goes up and down. There are a number of GPs that feel like this is the right decision, a number of GPs that felt that this wasn't the right decision. But I think that's pretty much translated into the main population as well. There is an argument, and I do understand it, but there is an argument that you follow the science, you follow what has already been done, therefore go with the 3 weeks, certainly for the Pfizer vaccine. Equally, it's not so much that evidence is against 12 weeks, it's that this data doesn't really exist. So we don't really know the effect. The original Pfizer trials did show that there was a significant protection, even with the first dose, but we still haven't got the data to show how effective it's going to be after 12 weeks. So it is a slight risk from the government, but I do think there's a risk either way. When this was first brought out, we didn't have this new wave. We didn't have this whatever number wave you want to call it, but we didn't have this huge spike. Since we've had it, then I can completely understand the principle behind giving it to as many people as possible. I saw a really good blog the other day that used the analogy of driving. You'd love to drive with 2 headlights, but if you don't drive with 2 headlights, you'd rather everyone on the road is driving with 1 headlight rather than half of people driving with 2 headlights, half of people driving with 0. I haven't really put that analogy well, but you can see where I'm coming from. There is everyone having some form of protection. More people, double the number of people having some form of protection, in my personal view, is probably better than people having full protection, but only half of them. But like I said, there is a dividing line between, even in the GP community, I don't think there's any consensus whatsoever. I think the one area where there was a little bit of annoyance, certainly, and completely understandably, was when the policy was changed pretty much overnight. But patients who had their second appointment were having to be cancelled. Now, we're talking about the elderly here. We're talking about those that are over 80. But for GPs to have to cancel all the appointments they've already made was a real problem for them, and it was a real challenge. But I think since then, in terms of consensus, I just don't think there is a consensus there.
No, it's a really, really challenging issue. And as you say, there's a strong feelings on either side of the divide on this one. Just speaking generally then, so not too long ago, I think it was back in November, SIPFA and the Institute for Government put out our annual performance tracker. And there was some information in there around the general pressures on GPs created by the COVID pandemic. What would you say the pressures just generally, as far as COVID is concerned, are feeling like on the front lines at the moment? And does the delivery of the vaccination programme increase that pressure on business as usual any further?
Well, I mean, the vaccination programme is the priority for NHS England at the moment. Now, I think part of the challenges for GPs was that they were never really given a strong steer about what their priority should be. So it's all very well saying COVID vaccination should be a priority, which I think a lot of people would understand. But what work do you then remove in order to do that? I don't think there was ever that strong steer. There has been more murmurings recently from NHS England and also the BMA, British Medical Association, and the Royal College of GPs. There have been a bit more guidance coming out. But I think this was a real problem at the start. What work do you stop, deprioritise? We saw before Christmas as well that work was increasing for GPs. In the first lockdown, there was a lot of misplaced information that general practice was closed. This was never the case. Now, GPs had to reconfigure themselves completely to go to a remote system. Again, sorry, just in England, obviously, based on the say-so of NHS England, you know, we're moving to total triage. So everything would go for a phone call first rather than people having face-to-face appointments. That did reduce certainly some of the demand in the first place, not always in a good way. You know, there were patients who were avoiding general practice who shouldn't have been, but the demand wasn't huge at the start. Now, once we got into the second and third lockdowns, this just completely dissipated. So there's equally the same amount of demand, but it was all being done online for a start. I mean, most of it was being done remotely, but also you had GPs being off as well. You had a real problem. Now, there was, as I'm sure your listeners will know, there was a real recruitment problem in general practice and a workload problem even before this whole pandemic started. So now we've got a situation where you've got the biggest public health program of all time, you've got increased demand, plus you've also got GPs and staff members off sick. So I think the workload is really starting to tell for GPs at the moment. But again, I'd say that this has been a problem even before the pandemic workload. It's just getting worse, and it's something that I think will continue, certainly even while we're in lockdown, but even when we get out of the pandemic. There is a real structural problem in general practice at the moment where we're not getting enough GPs through compared to those that are leaving the profession.
And do you think central government have a role in solving that problem?
What I would say for central government is they know there's a problem. They understand this. I mean, Jeremy Hunt, even in 2015, when he was health secretary, had a commitment to increase the numbers by 5,000, increase the number of GPs by 5,000 by 2020. Now, in that time, we actually, I think, lost 1,000 to 2,000 GPs. So he was, 7,000 off his target in that case. So there is at least acknowledgement from the government. I think the problem is they don't really know how to solve it. They have brought in measures. They have tried different things. But the one time that we really saw an increase in GP numbers was for the 2004 contract, which was seen as being very beneficial for GPs and a lot of money going into general practice. We did see a boon in recruitment at this time. Unless we get something similar, I fear for what we're going to do with recruitment. Now, the way they have tried to get around this is by trying to increase the number of other roles, pharmacists, physiotherapists, even paramedics, social prescribers. Whether this works, I think the jury's still out, and I don't know if it will work, to be honest. I know that there are GPs that are really worried about the de-skilling of the workforce, that, for example, pharmacists can't deal with the same problems that GPs deal with. Certainly physician assistants have not got the same level of training as GPs. So I think there is a problem there, but there's certainly at least acknowledgement from government and NHS that there is a problem in GP recruitment.
So kind of wrapping up off of all of that then, you touched on the workforce issues for GPs. Just based on the experience of the pandemic to date, what do you think are going to be the lessons learned for general practice moving forward beyond the end of the pandemic?
I don't know if I can really say it's a lesson learned, but there is going to be a change in general practice. There's going to be, I think, the move to remote consultations, I think, is here to stay. I don't think we're going to see a time when there's no face-to-face appointments. That's just not going to happen. And there will be more of a redress and a balance, but there'll definitely be more remote consultations there were before. I think that's the main thing to say. Other than that, I think it's really hard to say lessons learned, because this is such, as you've heard so many times, this is such a unique event. What do you take out of this? You know, it's almost like saying, what lessons did we learn from the Spanish flu? I'd like to believe that there's not going to be anything like this coming up anytime soon. But I think maybe what we could say is a lesson learned would be to increased funding to public health. Now, again, something that is especially true for SIPFA members, I think. You would have seen the public health cuts being in local government. You've seen the public health cuts. I think we've learned that public health cuts are a really inefficient way of trying to save money. I think in the long run, it will cost money in the long run. I think that there will be a redress of that, and this really should be. We're not just talking about planning for a pandemic. We're talking about sexual health services. We're talking about addiction services. Putting money in there does actually save you money in the long term, and it benefits patients as well. I think I'm hoping that will be a big lesson learned from this pandemic.
Amazing. Well, thank you very much, Jamie, for taking the time out to speak to us today. And we hope to welcome you back to the podcast sometime soon once all this is over.
Fantastic. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Jamie for joining us this week. Next up is SIPFA President and CEO of University Hospitals Coventry and Warwickshire NHS Trust, Professor Andy Hardy. The very first COVID vaccine in England was delivered on his patch, and he kindly joined us to talk about the experience and give us his thoughts on the vaccine rollout to date.
My name is Alison Kroll. I am here with Andy Hardy. He is the current SIPFA President and also CEO of University Hospitals Coventry and Warwickshire NHS Trust. Thanks for joining us, Andy.
Good morning. Thank you.
So let's get started by discussing your year as president so far. What impact do you feel you've been able to make, and what are you looking forward to for the remainder of your term?
Well, it's obviously been an unusual and unprecedented time in history to be president of SIPFA, which has meant that my term today has been very, very different. And it's meant that really a lot of my presidency has been done in this way, utilising technology, which, you know, only 12 months ago, many of us had not used at all. And yet now it is second nature to use Teams, Zoom and other forums to have such conversations. So what's been very different, it's still been very fulfilling in that I've got to see the work of the Institute, both nationally and internationally. Also to speak to members from across different parts of the UK to see the great work they're doing and also contribute to some of their learning events and conferences. Still sort of about, you know, halfway through this year. I'm hoping that at some point before the end of the year, I might be able to get actually out of the office or out of home to actually meet some members. But if I don't, I don't. We can still do this and continue to look at the great work that SIPFA is doing to support its members, but also to influence policy at a unique time for the public sector. We use the word unprecedented a lot in the last 12 months because it has been a completely unprecedented year, but that has also meant unprecedented challenges for the public sector, of which we're all part in SIPFA. I think the public sector has really come to the fore in terms of its response to COVID in looking after our populations. And because of that, probably more so than ever, the public sector has been appreciated by the public here in the UK.
Great, thank you. So let's get into our first question about vaccines. So the first COVID vaccine in England was administered on your patch. What went into making that happen, and what was your experience like as CEO?
Well, firstly, as CEO, it was a moment of unparalleled pride, really, for the organisation. I've had the great honour and privilege to be chief exec here for about 10 and a half years, and it was a fantastic moment to be entrusted by the Department of Health, by government, to be the site of the very first COVID vaccination, not only for this country, but for the world. And literally on that day, back on the 8th of December, we had the world's media here in Coventry waiting for that first vaccination for a then 90-year-old lady, Margaret Keane, who's now 91, a fabulous lady. But obviously that didn't just come about overnight. The organisation, we spent a lot of time building up to that, becoming what I call a trusted organisation, one that is a calm organisation and a go-to organisation in terms of crisis. You know, one of the things we've done throughout COVID is giving mutual aid to colleagues from across the NHS in the Midlands and further afield. And also we've become a trusted media partner. We've had a lot of media throughout COVID. I'm pleased to say all very positive. And I started back in right at the peak, first peak in April, where we had a camera crew from Panorama here, obviously a highly respected outlet through the BBC. And then since then, we've had people from CNN, Sky News, NBC and others come here, and they learned that they could work with us. And so we were trusted to do the media side of it, but also to be able to deliver the vaccination. Because although obviously we all waited for vaccinations to come for a long time, and we should remember, of course, it's uniquely quick how the world of science has brought us a vaccination for COVID compared to what we normally experience, which is years, this was months. But once the decision had been made by the MHRA that first the Pfizer BioNTech vaccination was feasible and could be delivered, it was actually only a matter of days then that we were asked to get ready and to deliver. And so the first vaccine was delivered on the morning of the 8th of December. We only found out that we were going to be the site of the very first vaccination on the Sunday evening prior to that, so about 36 hours beforehand. We were up and ready to run for that first day. So a lot of work went into it, but I say it was an incredibly proud day and parallel, really, in my time as chief executive.
And also based on your experiences, do you have any reflections on the government's overall vaccination plan?
When we look back at this whole COVID period, there will of course be things we could have and should have done better, but hindsight's fantastic. But one thing I think actually we'll be celebrating is this government's approach to vaccination. Right up front, in my words, took a punt on vaccinations in number, not just the Pfizer-BioNTech, but also obviously Oxford, AstraZeneca, and Moderna, etc. And invested in these technologies very early on and made contracts in place. Also underwrote some of them that as an investment, because this was what the way out of this pandemic has got to be through a vaccination, not just in this country, but across the world. And I think the government did incredibly well to be on the front foot ahead of the rest of the world, really, in terms of contracting for these vaccines, not just one, but a number. And then also getting the country ready to actually give the vaccinations, because having a vaccine is only half the issue. Actually getting that vaccine to people's arms is the key, then, logistical challenge. And I think actually this has really shown the benefit of having a National Health Service where we can work across the whole country, but also having a public sector that's so interconnected, working alongside public health colleagues, the army as well, to get this out. And the fact that we stand here now really accelerating against the government's target to get top priority vaccines into people by the middle of February, we will do that. And I think we'll be the first country of large size to actually roll it out to a level where we can start to get back to some kind of normality. So I think on this front, the government has done incredibly well.
Okay. Do you have a view on the government's decision to space out the doses of the vaccine to 12 weeks?
Okay. Well, of course, it's been quite a contentious decision, because obviously when first people had their vaccines, it was understood that they'd have their second dose around about just after 21 days and, you know, in that fourth week. And then as we got into early January, that decision was overturned and extended to having their 12th week. And obviously this is a key decision based on public health needs and the fact that we are in this second wave of the pandemic here in the UK, one that is definitely seeing numbers higher than we saw in the first phase. It's in winter and we have new variants of the COVID virus, which are more contagious, and it would appear to have greater levels of mortality. So the decision was made to extend to 12 weeks from 3 to enable more people to have a first vaccine and give more people some protection against the disease. And I think on the basis of public health and the science that's available, it's an understandable decision. Of course, there are some concerns around the efficacy of doing that, when particularly with the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, it was only tested at an interval of 3 to 4 weeks afterwards to give that. And we've seen some early concerning results coming out of Israel, which is also doing well on vaccinated its population, although albeit a much smaller population. But I think at the moment, given the science that we've got, the challenge we're currently facing with the pandemic, I think it's an understandable decision that's been made and one that as an NHS we're supporting.
So there's also been lots of talk about the role of local governments in supporting the vaccine rollout and better data sharing with public health directors. Do you have any reflections on this?
Yeah, absolutely. And just going back and say, throughout this pandemic, I think the interdependencies and the close working across all parts of the public sector has really risen and shone. I've seen partnership working like we've never had before, actually, and things that we've talked about doing to get joining together across public health into local government and so the NHS, we've actually made happen. And that's certainly true for vaccination. So what public health directors have is local knowledge that of populations that we don't have in the NHS. And so working with them, particularly on this vaccination, is really important. And the area that really comes to mind is the area of those hard to reach communities, where often they have greater levels of deprivation. And we do know that it's quite stark to date, not in this country, but across the world, that deprivation has been a leading cause of mortality for this disease. So if we can work really closely with public health, the data they have and hold to help us get in to vaccinate the populations, even in those harder to reach populations, that's really, really important. So really welcome that. And here in Coventry and Warwickshire, we have great relationships with public health and they're incredibly valued by their NHS colleagues.
You mentioned hard to reach communities. It is true that Western countries have been able to move fairly fast with large stocks of vaccine. And there's, of course, less supply in developing countries.
Yeah. Yep.
The UK has committed funds to support the effort to ensure access to vaccinations in other nations. What are your thoughts on this? And do you foresee any difficulties with unequal access to vaccination internationally?
Okay, well, it's a massive question, really. I think we need to start from the premise that none of us are safe until we're all safe from this disease. And when I mean all of us, I mean the world. We saw how quickly this went around the world this time last year. It was just being reported in China. By the 31st of January, we had our first case in the UK. And, you know, 7-8 weeks later, on the 23rd of March, we went into lockdown. And we've had levels of lockdown ever since. This second phase is even more challenging than the first phase in terms of numbers and deaths. We need to ensure that the world is a safe place, not just the UK. I think it's fabulous that the UK has been at the forefront of leading that movement to bring vaccines to those sort of third world countries, countries that couldn't afford it otherwise. And through COVAX, the UK has helped raise £1 billion so far towards vaccinating people in poorer parts of the world. And as Matt, I think it's the last time I saw, it's about 250 million, £250 million to fund that. I think that's really important. And actually, you know, the UK has always been at the forefront of international collaboration. I think the UN, for example, was 75 years old this year, this month, actually. And I think it's really important that we do that. Of course, it's understandable that those countries who have money, in the first instance, they can be self-interested and look after themselves. And that is important. It's important to the populations those governments serve. But I think it's great that the UK is leading the way in thinking not just about its own populations, but the world and the global challenge that this pandemic has represented and is at the forefront of tackling that.
Great. Thank you. All that's really interesting and informative. Thank you. Thanks so much for joining us, Andy.
Thank you very much. It's been good to talk.
Really great insight into the vaccine rollout there from Andy. Last but not least, we were joined by SIPFA member Karen Wheatcroft. As repeat listeners out there will know, last episode we kicked off what will be a recurring segment looking at the experiences of SIPFA members during the pandemic and exploring how it's impacted their working lives. Karen joins us from Mersey Internal Audit Agency, an organisation providing assurance services to NHS organisations.
Hello everyone, I'm here with Karen Wheatcroft. Thank you very much for joining us today, Karen.
Hi everyone.
So, Karen, when did you qualify with SIPFA?
So, I've actually been SIPFA qualified since 2003, so a lot longer ago than I care to remember.
So, could you tell our listeners about your role, the organisation that you work for, a bit about your background and your experience of the public finance world since 2003?
I started with MIA as a trainee auditor straight from university. I completed a sports science degree, but I always had the intention of trying to find a role where I would become an accountant. That was the advice I took at school back then. It was before the days of degrees being linked to professional exemptions, so that was a good way to get in. MIA, just as a bit of context, is an NHS hosted shared service, so we provide internal audit, counter fraud and solution services to the NHS and now the wider public sector as well. And the NHS is a great supporter of professional development, and that's how they supported me to gain my SIPFA qualification and also develop the foundations of my career. So I've seen lots of people come through that route as well. Now I hold a role of operations director, which involves a wide range of corporate responsibilities running the organisation.
Great. So describe what your sort of typical working day pre-COVID, one wonders what we talked about pre-COVID, but if you can stretch your mind back, what did things look like for you on a typical day?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting term, pre-COVID, isn't it? And I guess typical role in our organisation, there isn't a typical day really, because we do such a variety of things. Myself and that of my colleagues, we're very much split our time between office, visiting client sites, and also that occasional working from home. We use that working from home really as an opportunity to dedicate time to completing things without being interrupted by phone calls or people. So it might involve driving in the morning to the office or driving to client sites. We'd have some face-to-face meetings or interactions, and then we'd plan some tasks in between that. And we also do a lot of learning events, trying to use workshops with our staff as well internally. So there's a lot of interaction between people and really using those relationships.
So that does sound like quite a fair amount of face-to-face engagement. Oh, I remember those days. But obviously COVID, I imagine as much for you as everybody else, COVID has fundamentally changed what your working life has been like over the last year. So what's your working experience like now day to day with the kind of mass movement to working from home? And I think your perspective will be particularly interesting coming from the health sector.
Definitely. I think that you can't lose that NHS perspective on what we've done. So at the beginning of the pandemic, it was really clear that we need to step down our core services because a lot of our clients are NHS organisations and they had to focus all their attention on the emergency response. So we moved quickly to remote working, deployed technology as a lot of organisations did, which has been absolutely crucial, and supported everybody with new ways of working at home as people started to really change what they did and how they did it because they didn't have that flexibility of being in the office and working in a way that had always worked. And we also had a lot of people redeployed voluntarily to NHS organisations. So we had a lot of accountants, public sector accountants that were qualified as well, supporting workforce division, operational teams, just doing different things to what they would do normally in their day jobs. In my role, I guess I was part of the executive team, and it was really important that we continued to keep a strong focus on managing our organisation, also supporting our staff and doing what we could with clients. So we had a real three-pronged focus for that first part of the pandemic. We did lots of advice and guidance, we did briefings, we did lots of comms as well as those hand-on roles. So it's been a really difficult time to see our clients and what they've been doing, but a really important and proud time of the organisation and how it's responded and how as leaders and particularly professionally qualified leaders, we've been able to just think differently to put some support into that process.
So you mentioned before that in the sort of pre-COVID world, working from home was already maybe a little bit embedded into the system, even if you weren't doing it full time. Do you think the fact that that was there in any capacity made the transition any easier?
I think for some people, definitely. I think we've got some people who really loved working from home, that flexibility of being able to just log on in the morning. I think we had people that were used to technology, so we had laptops, we had some of the practical things that I know other organisations that had to start from scratch on. We did have a corporate team who'd never worked at home, so our people who run our finance and our administration, our operations, they'd never worked at home, so they had the same challenges. But what we've got to remember is that was working from home as part of your job. I think working from home in a pandemic and that being the only option at that point that you have brought very different perspectives, especially as people were juggling their family commitments, their home situation, and the worries and the day-to-day news and coverage that was bringing, and obviously trying to contact clients and trying to work out how we did the best to close down our year end and the important things we needed to do, as well as sort of managing the transition to home. So I don't think it was an easy time, but possibly in terms of having people who'd had some experience, it was a little bit easier than some organisations who'd had to do that from a standing start.
Sure. So you talked a little bit there about some of the issues that you faced, but were there any maybe notable challenges in the early days or any over the last year at all, any particular troughs or, and add to that, any particular peaks, anything about work from home that the team across the board and yourself have enjoyed? Has it changed your work-life balance? Are there things you'd like to see taken forward?
Yes, I think one of the key things, I suppose it's a softer thing really, is that focus on person rather than organisation became very apparent from day one, that people were dealing with very different things in the way that they responded, in the way that they moved to that virtual working. So as an auditor and an accountant and a professional, systems, processes, consistency at organisation level are absolutely critical. But we found that in terms of communications and challenges and being able to be flexible and adapt some of that to people and individuals has certainly come through a lot more. And that's kind of in our makeup now in terms of how we do things and how we look at things. I mentioned earlier on that from a personal perspective, we did a lot of face-to-face, both internally and externally. And for me, I really miss that interaction. And I've spoken to quite a lot of colleagues, both within our organisation and outside. And that ability to see people face-to-face, to have the softer conversations rather than just be on screen, to talk between meetings, the office cooler conversations, they're really hard in a virtual environment. And we've been doing quite a lot of work around how you set up chat room, coffee breaks, lunchtime catch-ups, and some of the softer stuff which gets you talking a bit differently. But it's still not the same as seeing somebody in the office or in an environment where you can talk and actually get the body language and the other things that come with that. For me and for others as well, I suppose that blurring of home work life has been a huge challenge, as well as an opportunity and a positive. So looking back to the first lockdown, I was juggling a very young family with our jobs, no childcare cover or sort of interaction with family, etc. And then trying to keep abreast of what was happening generally. The home work life boundaries really blurred. Your office was your lounge or your dining table, as some of my colleagues had found out. and the boundaries just weren't there in the same way. The flexibility was fantastic in terms of being able to blur those boundaries because we needed that early on. And over time, it's trying to work out how you maybe put some artificial boundaries in, making sure you take that time out, and particularly now in the winter when it's quite difficult, trying to encourage people to say, you know, you need to be able to leave the house and go for a walk, or you need to be able to do something. Otherwise, the temptation is to put your laptop back on in the evening and maybe not get that break that you really need. And I think a really practical one, which is a bit more operational, is that how do you stop your diary becoming full of back-to-back virtual meetings? You get no time to reflect in between. You're not having to drive to another meeting, so you get that time to think about what's just happened and what you might need to do next. Your diary's empty, so somebody will book into it. So you might have a 9 to 10, 10 to 11, and then your day is suddenly consumed by virtual meetings. I think that's been really tricky, and trying to find the best balance to that, I think, is something that we're still looking at.
Of course, no, I think Zoom fatigue is a very, very real concern for so many people in so many different roles. But you talked a little bit there about feeling like there's a more person-centred approach, taking a more flexible approach to both how you communicate with staff, with clients, and flexibility in terms of ways of working. Do you feel like the way we work is set to shift permanently as a result of what we've experienced over the last year and are set to continue experiencing over the next few months? My immediate reflection on some of the things you were saying about flexibility in terms of our approach to individuals is that that could have some really positive benefits as far as sort of diversity and inclusion efforts are concerned in some of these public sector workplaces.
Definitely. And I think people are talking about new ways of working and how to harness the best from those new ways of working. And what we're really keen to recognise as well in our organisation is what's missing, because you can quickly move to, well, everybody's been able to work from home, we've been able to do jobs that we never thought would be able to be done remotely, and this is so much more efficient and we can get that done. But actually the softer things around interactions, relationships, networks, I think that's the bit that we probably need to reflect on in a bit more depth around if we are going to develop new ways of working, thinking a bit more detailed about what will they look like and how do we get the best of both situations. It's different, I said before, it's different about working at home in a pandemic, because that is the best place to keep you safe. And therefore you make that work and you find ways to do that. If you look at that and say, that's the situation for the next 12 months, 2 years, 5 years, and that's the new way of working as a norm, is that what people want? So I think people's expectations and work in the future is going to drive a lot of this in terms of people being able to reflect and say, what do you want from work? Is it the social interaction? Is it the practical things? Is it the efficiency of getting up and being able to do your job without having to leave your desk or your home or whatever? And we've got some people who absolutely love working from home and some people who are really struggling, especially during this latest lockdown when it's become real. And actually, we thought at the beginning it might be a few months. We thought it might be 6 months. Suddenly, you know, we're looking at a year. And even then, it's going to be longer than that, as you know, you can see. So I think that flexibility absolutely is brilliant, and people being able to take that flexibility and it not, you know, being something that you feel you need permission or an extra ask to do. But we do need to find the balance between relationships and the softer things, and trying to work out how we do provide workspace that is both conducive to efficient and effective working, but also to people's expectations and wants and needs from a working environment, and just being able to touch base and see people more face to face, which I know from a personal perspective, that's exactly what I miss. And I know that if I look forward into my working life, I need that back in my working life at some point, and would like to see that that's at the end of the tunnel somewhere.
Of course, I think quite a lot of people are going to share that feeling. So with these kind of opportunities to reflect that you're seeing coming off the back of how things have had to change from the pandemic, just from a personal standpoint, what do you think your ideal sort of public sector workplace of the future would look like?
Yeah, so for me, it's a blend of that remote working, client facing work that we do, and also the office being there. And whilst we had a blend of that prior, I don't think you can ever go back. We've got the experience that COVID-19 has brought. It's going to be different, and I think we all accept that. Technology absolutely has brought opportunities to do things more efficiently and effectively. We've talked about agile working in the past, but it's been quite tricky with the culture in an organization to make huge changes. But actually, we've got a great opportunity now, because people have seen that we can work in different ways, to maybe really redefine the workplace and what that means. Collaboration, touchdown are all words that you hear when you talk about agile working. Not a place that everybody goes and works from every day. So can we find a way that offices become collaboration spaces, places where people can touch down, interact with each other, use it as a practical place where you may need access to certain things that you can only get in the environment where you can provide that as an organisation? But then I kind of look at that and say, what does this mean for team building? What does it mean for cultural stuff, which is really, really important? How do you get that if people are more remote from each other? Can you achieve it in that way? For us, anyway, we want to take the positives from creating different workplaces because I think we can do that now going forward. But we don't want to do the knee-jerk reaction, which you hear a lot now, that people are closing offices, looking at remote working as being the way to take this forward. I think we want to think quite carefully and give proper consideration to what is the appetite for the working space or the working office of the future, and how do we create that? We work across four geographies. So we do have four office sites, and you kind of think, yeah, let's not think about what we do with those offices straight away. We need the time to reflect, come out of this, and then think about what's worked, but what works in the longer term, not just what's worked during a pandemic.
Of course. And I think those are going to be some really interesting reflections that lots of people are going to kind of have on their minds as the vaccine rollout extends further. And hopefully we come back to some form of normality, even if that normality isn't quite what it looked like before. I think that's about all we've got time for. So thank you very much, Karen, for joining us today. It's really great to be able to get the perspective of SIPPA members on some of these issues.
Thank you. It's been great to pull some of the reflections together as well.
You've been listening to SIPPA Speaks, and that was Alison Kroll in conversation with Karen Wheatcroft. That about wraps it up for this episode. Thank you to all of our guests for joining us this week. Bye for now, and we'll see you again next time.